Start of interview with J.R. Jayawardena on the 6th of January
1968. I was wondering what led you to take an interest in politics.
Firstly, my family was a political family. My father had been in politics, so had my two uncles. And from my youth, I used to attend meetings of the National Congress and also take part in elections. Secondly, we were at the beginning of the Second World War. And in India, the Indian movement for freedom had been increasing in its activities against the British rule. Whereas we in Ceylon had been following a program of complete cooperation without securing advance in our political independence. So many of our younger people thought it was time that we joined the Ceylon National Congress and reformed it and made it more active. That's why in 1939, myself and a few young friends of mine joined the Ceylon National Congress to seek to make it more active and follow in the footsteps of the Indian National Congress.
The NSSP was just beginning at that time, and I was wondering what whether you considered Marxism and whether you regarded it at that stage.
Yes. The organizers of the LSSP were my friends in school and in the university. And when they returned from their education in England, they were all, I think, animated by the same idea of being against imperialism and seeking freedom. They formed the Youth Congress. But I was then too much involved in my practice. I had just joined the bar and did not wish to divert attention from earning my living. But I was very sympathetic to their movement against imperialism. And when they formed the Sama Samaja Party, I could not accept Marxism as such. These two factors made me not join them at the time, in 1936.
What would you say are your objections to Marxism?
Firstly, its attitude to religion. Secondly, its use of violence as a means to an end. And thirdly, its goal of dictatorship as a means to the withering away of the state.
This is very interesting because today the UNP claims to be socialistic in its policy, and as does the SLSP. I was wondering how you would differentiate it from the brand of socialism which the Marxists desire.
We have said that we are for democratic socialism, maintaining the democratic freedoms of elections, freedom of speech, freedom of opposition. But Marxism does not have those necessary qualities.
Mm-hmm. But haven't you, as well as SLSP, worked within an economic framework which is called a mixed economy?
Yes.
Doesn't socialism imply going further?
Yes. But Marxism is something more than socialism.
Now, I was wondering whether this is a head more second day subject, whether, but since it has come up, I was wondering whether the UNP has not failed to clarify its socialistic objective.
Quite possible.
For instance, somehow or the other, the Marxist leaders seem to have established a general opinion that they know everything about economics, whereas the right-wing people do not. But of course, when they put the test a little while ago, that is a different question.
Yeah.
But I was wondering whether the UNP as a party could devote more attention to specific economic policy and theory.
Well, in our 1965 election manifesto, we laid down quite clearly what our objectives were. We would broadly define that democratic socialism. It doesn't mean we go all the way in socialism. So if you do, you may not have a democracy.
And you would give the private sector some place in the economy of Ceylon?
Not some place, you'd give them a very big place. To say that socialism merely means the socialization means of production, distribution, exchange, is putting it much too simply. Then one doesn't need a manifesto.
You mean you can just state that and that's that?
Yes. So far, no government has achieved that. At least by the vote.
But then you would say that the primary conflict is regarding the nature of the government, the nature of the constitution and the political structure.
Not that. I would say the primary consideration would be the existence of the democratic freedoms, and through that to achieve economic freedom or socialism.
Of course, there's a non-Marxian right-wing view that which has recently developed, not so much in Ceylon, I think in some other countries, that particularly in underdeveloped states, the democratic freedom sometimes hinders economic freedom and economic progress.
Maybe, but who has the right to judge? The majority of the people can express their view only through the vote. So they may reject my socialism. Unless you say we don't want the vote, they may reject Marx. They may reject Marx himself. He may think that he knows everything, and the people may prefer something else.
So I'm sort of afraid, rather.
Yeah.
So I may come back to the days of the National Congress. Would it be correct to say that BSN Nayaka helped you and encouraged you when you decided to contest the state council election?
I was then in the Congress. Mm-hmm. I was the secretary of the Congress with Ms. Abhisen Nayaka. I had been in politics for about 2.5 years when the Kalinia by-election took place in 1943. So I was a party man. And Sir D.B. Jaffer, who was a sitting member for Kalinia, went to India as a representative, and he became vacant, and I was obvious choice, having family connections with Kalinia.
It would seem that both you and Dadisen Nayaka had some conflict with old Mr. D.S.N. Nayaka on this question of a resolution you brought that was it that people should be released from jail, or that the CP members of the consort should be admitted to the National Council?
In the State Council, we, on several issues, did not vote with anybody. Sometimes the budget, on various skills, release of the best news, and so on, but those were not major conflicts. In the Congress, the young group wanted independence of Agol. So G.S. Chennanayake stood very strongly for dominion states. That was a major conflict he had with him. And the independence group succeeded. He thought that might hamper his negotiations with the British, since it was a wartime there.
Was it so much a conflict of objectives as one of tactics?
Our point was that there was no such thing as dominion states from a legal and constitutional point of view. And in the British Parliament, that point had been stressed by various political leaders, that different dominions had different constitutions. They were independent. So we thought, why should not call it independence? But he, I think, thought it may, during wartime, give problem to the British authorities, with whom he was cooperating and who were helping him and he was helping them to get freedom after the war. They might construe this as being an attempt to break away from the Commonwealth. And when the Constitution was drafted after freedom, there was no mention in it about independence. And the word state of Sudan was to have the status of a self-governing country within the Commonwealth. We insisted that that should be called the Independence Act. So G.S. Chennanayake agreed, and in one telegram we got the answer, yes. So both sides were satisfied after the fall.
I was wondering whether he agreed with you basically, but felt that at that stage, as far as timing went, in the war years, an emphasis on this aspect was...
Maybe. We can discuss it with him.
In fact, that brings us to the steps towards independence. I mean, the story of how the commission was boycotted officially and worked on privately has been told. But I was wondering about the role of people like Jenny and Leighton and Moore in the steps towards independence.
They must obviously have helped Mr. Chennanayake, because a very strong bond grew up between these four or five people during the war.
How was it that Jenny came to the G.S. Chennanayake, OEG, the Vodna?
Maybe during the wartime he also was a civil defense commissioner. They realized his capacity as a constitutional authority. And he thought it was good to cooperate with them, as we found later he himself became a knight, found that they were okay with the British authorities.
Some people have put a very cynical, presented a very cynical opinion on this, saying that Jennings knew which side his bed was buttered on, but...
Those who don't succeed. Master.
What about the methods used by Mr. Chennanayake and OEG? I mean, there are all sorts of rumors about subtle methods like promising the Governor Generalship to...
We were really out of all those. You see, we were a younger group. And we were carrying on our independence campaign. Addressing meetings and asking for non-cooperation in the case we can get freedom. And possibly some of us were on the borderline of arrest ourselves, if not for Mr. G.S. Chennanayake, who we have stopped it, he was very powerful with the British then. And our campaign may have helped him, though we never discussed it.
Oh, that's very interesting, because I was under the impression that W.S. Chennanayake was part of your group, and I thought because of he was a son.
No. Mr. Chennanayake didn't discuss, until we got freedom and joined the cabinet. We were quite different from him, politically.
Oh, that's interesting.
And he had left the Congress?
Yes.
He left the Congress.
Did he consult you in when he formed the UNC.
Oh yes. He invited the Congress also to join.
And the Congress and the Sinhala Mahasabha both existed as entities within the UNC for quite some time.
Sometimes, yes.
Wasn't it rather awkward having these two separate bodies within
it
one?
It was. We used to have open sea stocks at that time. That's how these things grow.
Yes. Oh, I suppose that's why in 47 you get several UNC candidates contesting each other.
Yeah. There were not many, but there were a few.
I had a glance at those statistics, and it would seem that in some constituencies you lost the seat because
of that. Yes. You just couldn't help it. You see now how the party idea has grown. No man can go outside his party and win.
But then there were contending groups.
There were strong party members.
Well, would it be correct to say that there were contending local factions in each?
Local faction, local families, local individuals.
To take up another subject connected with that era, the executive committee system. In what committee were you?
Home committee.
What are your views on the functioning?
I was never in favor of the committee system.
That's very interesting. On what grounds?
Because an executive can't function through a committee. The minister has to consult his committee members. Secondly, a strong party system exists, then how can a committee function? In the committee you find opposition members also, who will know all the secrets. We had no parties at that time of any value.
Could the minister take a decision and then seek committee approval after?
He might, but then must use the committee then. The strong-minded men in the committee, they might present it.
How did your minister get on with the committee?
You see, during the wartime, things were easier. Everything was overshadowed by the war. So there was very little area in which we could function independently.
Mm. But 46, 47, there must have been some...
War was over in 45. Mm. When the Sobri Commission Constitution, we knew that something was coming.
So your minister had no real conflicts with members of his committee?
No. Our minister was Sir Mahadeva, who was a very quiet, unassuming man.
Did you feel that the system was rather cumbersome and slow?
Yes, it was. Now it would be impossible to function.
What about its interim usefulness as a means by which younger politicians got some experience in administration?
I don't think that's very valid. Some of them were dismissed for bribery.
They can't.
Yes. In my own committee there were two, I think. My first vote in Parliament in State Council was to eject two of my colleagues. This is Mr. Abhay Gunasekhar, I think. Ambimurthy.
And I presume the only administration you were interested in was the appointment?
Appointment, transfer, yes.
Just a minor point which, with reference to something mentioned by J.L. Fernando. Did you know anything about the vote that was taken when to choose the acting chairman of the board of ministers, I think, when J.S. Naika flew to London?
No, I didn't know.
That means the state councillors were not consulted as such?
No.
Finally, with reference to 40, one sphere I am interested in is the nature of electioneering in those days. I presume it was very much a personal type of organization.
Electioneering?
Yes. At the same Kelly and 42.
There was no party organization in such.
Did you do any house-to-house campaigns?
Oh yes, I did the house. A long campaign for about 3 months.
How much did the campaign cost in those days?
Well, tremendous stuff, because you have to get cars, you have to get flags. Now, of course, it's been somewhat less.
In 47, did the same conditions prevail, or did the UNP have more of an organizational structure?
No, we didn't have till about 60, really.
Oh, that's
yeah.
Interesting. Did you have party branches?
We had, but not so well organized as now.
Mm-hmm.
The country wasn't so party-minded either.
Any youth leagues at all in the 50s?
No, yes, we always had youth organization, but not as it is today.
What do you think has helped to improve this organization?
Well, the continuous propaganda, time, new generation, contesting as a party, and the gradual education of the people on party lines. Once the voter begins to think as a party, of course, the rest follows. We don't want organization so much. 3.5 million voters, very few are in the party anywhere in the world as party members.
So, on the one hand, while election expenses have lessened because of this new regulation, would it be correct to say that maintaining the party structure and the branches and so on and so forth means additional expense and need for more money?
Oh, yes, of course, sir.
Looking back, do you feel that in the 40s and 50s, in 47 and in the early 50s, your and even in 1960, your organization was too loose? If
you
had a better organization,
it would have been... No, I don't think so. I don't think the organization should be too tight. After all, the voter must vote. You can't organize him to vote.
No, but isn't the organization important in putting across propaganda?
No, that doesn't mean such a well-knit organization. Meetings, pamphlets, press.
But would it also be correct to say that looking over the whole period, 47 to 65, local big shots, you know, in various constituencies who are pro-UNP would tend to resist centralization because that would reduce their influence?
I think their influence goes gradually as the level of education spreads and the people become party-minded. My view is that the organization is less and less useful. People begin to think in a certain way without so much pressure from the top. And we have settled down now to government and opposition in parliament, democracy. And a government is judged by its results, its impact on the people, cost of living and employment. And whatever government may say, that ultimately will decide the people's wish, even if the opposition says nothing.
In other words, you're saying that the economic factors have become very important, more important than before.
I won't say economic alone.
Mm-hmm.
The acts omission and commission of the government become important during his term of office. Maybe economic, maybe social, maybe religious, maybe language, maybe behavior. The people know we can turn them out. We let them live out. And the whole time they are thinking. Those who voted as well as those who are new voters.
How is this sort of system with competing parties and election provinces and more being supplied by government so as to win voters and so on and so forth led to a situation where the people expect far too much from government?
Quite possible. Not only here, all over the world is so. And my view is that in democracy, government changes once in 10 years. By and large.
Let me say, people get tired of...
Where there are two equally strong groups. Even if those who voted, vote in the same way, except for a few marginal defections. The new voter makes a difference. Not bound by the earlier voting. He generally votes against the government. It's both part of the Democratic.
The point you made would imply that you believe that now the politics still not have been polarized between the UNP on the one hand and the SLSP, and that the Marxists have really little place, they are on the fringe.
That's right. They may make a difference. Just as the Indian vote makes a difference in some regions, or the Tamil vote, or the Catholic vote, or the Marxist vote. But the major groups are the UNP SLSP, and the others have to attach themselves to one or the other, which may be a deciding factor.
Isn't there a possibility that the LSSP will pull the SLSP into more radical policy, and in the process the SLSP might split and one section might come over to the UNP?
You mean the voter or the candidate?
I think you have MP, but...
We have our own MPs.
Pardon?
We have our own MPs.
Well, MPs and the groups around them...
It did happen in 64 December. The government was defeated because some of them lived by Mississippi de Silva, broke away and came from.
Yes, I know of that. I was not here at that stage. What is it correct to say that even before that group came, some others had left earlier when the Marxists joined?
No.
Rajaraja,
few? May have been for other reasons. One or two had left.
Is it permissible for me to ask you to mention, describe the story of this coup?
Timing of the crossover and vote of no confidence. Yeah.
Was it carefully managed and timed?
It was carefully managed, but the timing was theirs. They dissolved parliament, they prorogued parliament and had the vote on that day.
Mm-hmm.
So we managed it to fit in with their timing.
You were preparing for this for some time, were you? Does that mean that you had conducted negotiations with Silva very much earlier?
When the Marxists joined in May, we knew their dissatisfaction. Because it came up in the Deputy Committee of the Party too. And we thought there would be a breakaway then, a strong opposition, but somehow that was dissipated. Had a very good majority. Then after their budget and their proposal to nationalize the press, we found a lot of support among the SLFP, people who were against the Marxists. They brought a press council bill, which is very drastic, about October, November in Parliament. And even Mr. C.P. De Silva and his whole group, I think, were supporting that too, though they were not happy. That's passed the Senate. And if it got through the lower house, I think we would not have succeeded on December 3rd. The whole press would have been almost muzzled without nationalization. But we were able to delay the discussion of the bill